Thank you, Mr. Washburn. It's a beautiful song to fit perfectly with just giving a prayer, knowing that God hears everything. I didn't mention, my mind was distracted, just welcome to all the visitors that we have with us. It's nice to have you here in Indianapolis. It's a gorgeous day. Things are cooling off a little bit, which I am very thankful for camp. And so hopefully it'll stay that way for all week long. So when we think about the world, when we think about everything that it teaches us, one of the things that we see oftentimes is this dominance-based leadership. Somebody who's in full control, a culture that is fascinated with the alpha male. Somebody who has supreme authority, the dominant one, whoever's in control, and somebody who leads by strength and authority, no questioning them. It's used in leadership circles around the world, in business and sports. Oftentimes it comes up in our family discussions as well. So when you hear that word alpha, what comes to mind? What's the first picture that you have? What's the image that comes? It's probably all over the place when you think about it, of what you actually popped up in there. Sometimes it's the alpha and the omega. Yeah, that's one of the first ones. We'll actually look at the scripture today that talks about that. Maybe it's a father or a mother. We're almost getting into football season. Maybe it's the hardest hitting guy on a football field. Maybe it's Mr. Universe. Maybe he's one of the greatest CEOs in the country right now, in the world. We have lots of different avenues we could take this. It might just be somebody who has a dominant personality in the room. Maybe a coworker that you have. So think about that. Think about where your mind goes when you hear that. Because, interesting enough, much of our thinking of an alpha male has been derived from what we believe the way that wolf packs operate and function. This idea that there is a alpha at the top of the pack, and from then, they fight for hierarchy and rank all the way down through until they basically get to the omega at the bottom. That omega at the bottom is usually low man on the totem pole. They're the ones that are pushed around. They're the ones that are victims of bullying. They're the last ones to get food. They're out oftentimes by themselves. Is that what our families look like today? When we think about our families, have we created this sophisticated hierarchy of assigning status, positions, ranks within our family? Well, the original studies of monitoring wolf packs and how they operated, they started back in the 1940s and they worked with them all the way through the 1970s. But there was a problem with what they did. As they viewed these wolves, as they monitored how they reacted, the wolves that they were watching were actually wolves in captivity. They were wolves in captivity. More recent research, which actually watches them in their normal habitats, has changed the idea. So in 1999 and in 2000, there's a man by the name of David Meck. He published research after 13 summers of spending with wolf packs in Canada. He watched them, monitored them, watched them how they interacted. And what he ended up discovering is that generally, instead of a alpha and then a beta and then all the way down through the rest of the ranks, it's this alpha pair. Not because they fought their way to the top, not because they were the most powerful, but this alpha pair ends up being the parents. They were the parents of the rest of the wolves in the pack. So they naturally took that position, and they didn't fight for dominance or superiority. They were the parents. And so they cared for all their other children as they were, the pups were being raised, and they came up to ages where they could go out and start their own families. The parents controlled the distribution of food. They generally prioritized the youngest when it came to getting enough food so that they could grow naturally in the way that they needed to be. Wolf packs, the mother and the father, they're actually usually monogamous. The small exception to that is when one of them dies. And they're very seldom apart. Usually that was only during the denning period where the mother was having the pups and the father was having to go out and get food and bring it back. So this was really a tight-knit family that they see with these wolf packs. I loved wolf packs growing up. It was one of my favorite animals. I had posters of wolves. I had a clock of wolf. I had a little knife. One of my boys actually has it now. I think that they keep it in their room. I had wolves everywhere, watching them go through Yellowstone. And so it was interesting as we see that this paints a very different picture than all the stories that we see. All these packs that we thought were about dominance, it all really boils down to responsibility. Responsibility of caring, love. Not this strict dominance hierarchy that they fought for and that they beat everybody else to. It's a family unit, just like we run today. It's not about power, but it's about care. It's about concern. So do we run our families like an alpha, or do we run our families like parents? When we step back and think about it, and we think about what we're doing, where God is taking us, the destination that we're looking for at the end in the kingdom is a family. That's exactly what God is doing. So I don't ask, who's the alpha in your pack, but are you fighting to be the alpha in your pack? Are you fighting to be the alpha in your pack? That's what we have to ask ourselves every single day, is how am I treating my family? How am I treating those around me? Because the answer to that question will end up shaping your marriage, it'll shape your family, and ultimately shape your relationship with God. Because at the end of the day, God designed the family with support, purpose, and structure. Yeah, that's a funny one. See, I told you, I throw in some funny pictures at times just to keep you awake. But families aren't based on dominance. They should never be based on dominance. It's about God-ordained function. That's what the family is supposed to be. It is supposed to be a functioning unit. Functionality. You know, parents lead by the example and the responsibility for the rest of them. It's not this rivalry that they're trying to get power back and forth. Through Genesis, we get a very good understanding at the very beginning of God establishing what he wants from families. That it's not this random order, but he specifically created man, and then he created woman to complement the man, to be with the man, to help him. That pattern we still follow today. It's still something that humanity sees all around us. Now, the structure is misunderstood in a lot of families. It's misunderstood in our world because people hear structure, they immediately default to inequality. Well, I can't do that, or you won't let me do that. But we have to think of it more as roles, responsibilities. We can't think of it as limitations. If you would head over to 1 Corinthians chapter 11 and verse 1, because God's structure is not about value at all. It's never about value, but it's about function. He values us all the same. He gives us all the same potential. So this section starts off by making a profound statement, you know, before getting into head coverings and men looking like men, women looking like women. I caught a little bit of the sermonette. I was out with Brian, but I think this is actually very close to what Mr. Cobb was talking about with the follow me aspect. 1 Corinthians 11 starting in verse 1, it says, imitate me just as I also imitate Christ, right? He was doing the following. This was Paul writing saying, hey, I'm doing everything I can to match up to the expectations of Christ. Match me and you'll be doing the same thing. He says, now I praise you, brethren, that you remember me in all things and keep the traditions just as I delivered them to you. But I want you to know that the head of every man is Christ, and the head of woman is man, and the head of Christ is God. You know, he begins with what we cover often, putting on Christ, mirroring Christ's personality, his attitude, the way he worked with people, letting him live in us and through us, that we become an example to everybody we encounter, his character, personality. But this is a structure of order. This is not a superiority. It's never about superiority. When we think about what Jesus Christ did, because Christ submits to the Father, yet he is equal with him. I always think about Philippians 2:6. Philippians 2:6 is where it says, Jesus Christ, being in the form of God, did not consider it robbery to be equal with him. Right? It's not this fight of who gets the final say. Who had the most converts? Who called the most people? It's never this power struggle between the two. Jesus submits to the Father because there is a order that they're trying to teach us, they're trying to show us. You know, husbands, wives, children, we all have the same opportunity of being children of God, being part of his family. And so everything God teaches us is that being with family is not about competition. It's not about competition. It's about alignment and making things work to the best of their ability, function to the best of their ability. And so just like in wolf packs, the parents lead because they're responsible. And we're told that the head of the church is Christ. The head of Christ is God. We're below that. And then wives are to be submissive to their husbands. Not because anybody's better than anybody. You know, at the very beginning of the Bible, we're told that we will be like them. Not just men, not just women, not young, not old. He says, all of you will be like us. We are creating you for this. And so that's what we have to fight for. And this is why family is so important. This is what we try to cling to. This is what we cling to. There gets to be confusion, though, because the church functions the same way. Because we are a family, and we're supposed to use the gifts that God gives to us. Thankfully, as time goes on, as science gets better, we have a better understanding that this structural and functionality, these differences between men and women, they're real. God created them to be different. Not that one sex is smarter overall or universally than the other. Nobody's superior. But both are very valuable in what they do, what they can provide. They're actually complementary strengths. They're complementary strengths. One does better with the other. And that's what's amazing to see is when this, you know, when we think about women's brains, they have a higher cerebral flow, cerebral blood flow, and a greater gray matter density. So they often show a high activity in the prefrontal cortex and the limbic regions, while men often show stronger front-to-back connectivity related to motor skills and spatial perception. What this leads to is women's systems are designed for integration and communication. Surprise, surprise, right? Not something unknown. And men's are for targeting, processing, and action. So when women are talking to us, we're automatically going, how do I fix this? Where's the problem? And at the end we go, it takes husbands a while to realize this. We go, oh no, I'm just supposed to listen. I'm not a fixer right now. I'm a listener. And so these are natural problems that we find in marriages and confusion about, hey, my husband doesn't listen to me. He just tries to fix my problems. He's trying to fix me all the time. Yeah, but that's literally how God wired our brains. Now we have to learn to tamper that, right? We have to learn to be receptive and go, I hear you, let me listen. And without giving anything else, right? It's this give and take of understanding what it is that God did with us. When we think about it, intelligence is not one dimensional. You know, we casually throw around smart or intelligent, but it's a long list of items that really make intelligence. So you think about verbal ability, emotional intelligence, spatial reasoning, logical reasoning, captivity and problem solving. All of these things are what make knowledge, what make intelligence. On average, IQs are basically even across the board between men and women. One's not smarter than the other. But women often score higher in the verbal fluency and emotional recognition, while men are spatial reasoning and certain mechanical problem solving. Again, science tells us exactly, hey, God gave us different roles to provide for the family in a different way. This isn't new information. Now, the physical differences, they become a little more clear defined. We know that men have a greater muscle mass. The upper body strength is different. Our bone density is different. But when it comes to the way that our brains function and what we are able to provide as a service to family, we're just providing different elements. We're helping in different capacities. So let's look at the different roles. Let's think about what it is that we all fill with these. You know, husbands, we're called to be like Christ, even more so than mothers, because we are in a role where we are responsible. That's why wives are told to be submissive, but at the same time, we are submissive to Christ, and so we have to honor that. We aren't seen as this competition. It's not a competitive role that we're in. If you head over to Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 25, we get a clear understanding of what these roles look like, what we're to become. Ephesians chapter 5, if you look at verse 25 here. For husbands, we have to handle ourselves very well. The relationship between Christ and the church is a great example for us to remember. We're allowed to make decisions. We're allowed to run different things. here as a family, as a congregation. And so we have to put that into family context as well. This is Ephesians 5. If you look at verse 25. Verse 25 says, "Husbands, love your wives just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for her, that he might sanctify and cleanse her with the washing of water by the word, that he might present her to himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that she should be holy and without blemish. So husbands ought to love their own wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself, for no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it. But just as the Lord does the church, just as the Lord does the church." Right? This standard doesn't get any higher. As a husband, as a man, I look at this and I go, "Are you serious right now, God? Are you serious? This is the plateau of what you're going to say, hey, live up to this. This is what I want you to aspire to." And I go, "This is unreal. Not ever going to happen. Sorry." But we try. I won't ever measure up to that. I know I won't ever measure up to that, but it doesn't mean I'm ever going to stop trying. Because I want to live up and say, I have done my best to put my wife into a position where she is without spot, where she is perfect. She has been set up for success and that she is going to be perfect. That's what God is doing with us. That's what Christ is doing with the church. God says, here's the pattern that I've always gone through. I want you to be in my family. I want you to succeed at all of these things. We have to remember that. And that's a very different leadership than what we're used to. Anywhere, business, in the world around us, in the families around us, governments, whatever it may be, we don't see this type of mentality anywhere other than with God's people. Because these are very specific expectations of how a family is supposed to work. Right? Think about what Christ did. Because even when he knew that the apostles were going to turn from him, they were going to deny knowing him. They were going to be put on the spot, say, hey, you've been with this guy. You talk like him. We know you've been. We know you were right there. We saw you with him. No, that wasn't me. That was somebody else. You can write down Matthew 20, verses 25 through 26. And knowing that he was going to be denied, that he was going to be left alone by all the humans that surrounded him, he still wanted to remind people what it meant to be a servant as he was getting ready to lay down his life. He says, "You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and those who are great exercise authority over them." And then verse 26, "Yet it shall not be so among you, but whoever desires to become great among you, let him be your servant." He says that is the biggest accomplishment you can have is if you become a servant. And that completely flips this worldly idea of an alpha upside down, doesn't it? The alpha doesn't exist when the alpha is the servant, when they're the ones doing everything they possibly can to help everybody else. The hardest job, what they think is the lowest job. Now, it can look like many different things, but we have to figure out what that looks like in every situation. Different situations. Now, wives. Wives, you are essential to families, the way that they function. When we come back from camp, my wife is actually heading the opposite direction. She's running away from me. She's going to Massachusetts to visit a friend who just had a baby to help her out for a week. And I was already thinking, like, oh, what am I going to do? Two of the kids are going with her. The other two are going to my mom's house to help her. I'm like, I'm going to be all alone. I looked at her this week, I go, what am I going to eat? I can do enough. It's like, I can survive on peanut butter. It's fine. Now I can cook enough to survive. But they do. Our wives, I don't have to think about a lot of, let's say, 95% of what goes on in our house. My wife takes care of all of it. I don't have to even think about it. It doesn't even cross my mind most of the time. And then when she asks me something, I'm like, that's your job. Wives' roles are not secondary. There is nothing secondary about them. You are indispensable. You function and you run things. It doesn't matter whether you have children or not. You are a major asset to the family unit. You always will be. If you look at Proverbs 31, if you look at verse 10, if you ever question the worth of a woman, I don't know of any better place than right here. Because this chapter describes a woman of strength, wisdom, capability. You're going to see all these things come out through this section. What this is here in Proverbs 31, it's the words of King Lemuel from his mother. So this is actually what his mother says. This is Proverbs 31. We're going to read through a good couple of sections here. We're going to read from verse 10 all the way down through verse 28. It says, "Who can find a virtuous wife? For her worth is far above rubies. The heart of her husband safely trusts her, so he will have no lack of gain. She does him good and not evil all the days of her life. She seeks wool and flax and willingly works with her hands. She is like the merchant ships. She brings her food from afar. She also rises while it is yet night and provides food for her household and a portion for her maidservants. She considers a field and buys it. From her profits, she plants a vineyard. She girds herself with strength and strengthens her arms. She perceives that her merchandise is good and her lamp does not go out by night. She extends her hand to the poor. Yes, she reaches out her hands to the needy. She's not afraid of snow for her household is clothed with scarlet. She makes tapestry for herself. Her clothing is fine linen and purple. Her husband is known in the gates when he sits among the elders of the land. She makes linen garments and sells them and supplies sales for the merchants. Strength and honor are her clothing. She shall rejoice in time to come. She opens her mouth with wisdom and on her tongue is the law of kindness. She watches over the ways of her household and does not eat the bread of idleness. Her children rise up and call her blessed, her husband also, and he praises her. Many daughters have done well, but you excel them all." Verse 30, charm is deceitful and beauty is passing, but a woman who fears the Lord, she shall be praised. Give her the fruit of her hands and let her own works praise her in the gates. You know, I say the expectations in Ephesians are unattainable for a husband. I don't even know what you call that. When you look at the expectations of what God has put out, but God doesn't ever give us expectations or ask us to do things that He hasn't equipped us for. So that means women are fully equipped to fulfill all of these things. Now we know that, you know, this is, when we look at this, this is definitely not a passive person and they are not secondary. This is somebody who is engaged. They are foundational to the entire family. Now the original intent of this, the original audience, it actually wasn't young women. This wasn't talking to women saying, "Hey, this is who you should be." This was talking to the young men saying, "Hey, this is the wife you should go find. You want a good marriage? You want something successful, something fun?" He goes, "Here are the traits. Here are the attributes. Here are some qualities that you should be looking for in a wife to marry. If you find this, snatch her up quick, because this is pretty spectacular." But these are the character traits that women possess. I've seen more women possess all of these. I've seen some possess some of these. And as we look at this list, we know that the main idea of this, this is a woman of boundless energy. I don't know how you do what you guys do at times. And it's hard to believe that a single person could accomplish all of these ideals. And so we know that there's poetry here, that this isn't just a, "Hey, this is the standard. You have to do all of these things or you're a failure." No, it's telling us that this is a lot of what women possess. These are the different traits. Does this mean every single one of you have to go out and start making garments and run a garment business? No. Does it mean you have to be a real estate mogul? No. Buy a vineyard with whatever money you make. That's not what this is talking about. This goes through this long list of character traits that say, this is what women are capable of. This is what they aspire to. This is what they are able to do. In addition to all that, the philanthropy that she has, the helping the needy, caring for those who are less fortunate, not only taking care of her own household, not only making money for her husband, but also for the less fortunate, those who don't have as much, those who are on hard times. These are the qualities. These are the mindsets, the attitudes. This is a God-fearing woman. Puts their value in knowing who they are. Not trying to be something that they're not supposed to be. Not struggling for control. Not struggling for authority. And so we have to be careful sometimes how we apply this. Because you aren't expected to do textile work all the time. And that's not what the point of this is. That's not what God's trying to teach us through this. But he says this is what you're capable of. This is what women possess, the abilities that you have, what you can contribute to the families. And so when we think about a virtuous woman, they're not only filled with intelligence, brightness, compassion, love, but they make good decisions. They're an asset. I can tell you, I make very few decisions without asking my wife. One, I know there's going to be consequences, right? Because I know I'm going to do it wrong. But it's because I value her thoughts. I value her opinions. She's a lot more intelligent than I am. And most of the time I'm going, hey, how do I fix this? What'll do best for us? And so I bring her into every discussion, every conversation, because I value the wisdom that she has. I value what she contributes to the family. She deals with the kids a whole lot more than I do. And so we see, again, going back to the idea that it's not this hierarchy. It's not about power. It's not about authority. It's about this perfect union. Two pieces of the brain, right? Two different brain. But that's one of the reasons that God tells us we become one. At marriage, he goes, you're no longer separate. You're no longer individual identities. He goes, you're supposed to complement each other. You're literally supposed to become one, because when you do that, you become a better person, more functional. You're able to do things better. So God says, for success in life, lean on this structure that I've built. Lean on this family that I am building currently. And we get to children. Children have to be raised with purpose. You know, I've been in the camp mindset for weeks now, months. I'll tell you, as soon as camp is over, Lizzie and I, usually on our way home, we're already talking about what we can do next year. It's not a, camp is not 1 week, camp is not a couple weeks, it's not a couple months. Camp is a year thing for me. Because we're always thinking about, how can I make their experience better? What can I do to set those kids up for success? How can I help them? And so when we think about kids in general, our kids, you know, are they accessories? Was it just a good time to start having kids? Have they become a burden? Do they create more problems than what we think they're good for? Or are they future leaders that we're training, that we're preparing? Because a family is not built overnight. It just can't. It never will be. It is raised intentionally through years and years of work, and effort, and time, and energy. Being purposeful and being thoughtful. Go back to Ephesians again. If you look at Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 1. Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 1. And God is the one who perpetuates a family, home, this life that we have and that we can create. And it's through his overseeing care that we excel, that we are become successful. And he tells us that children are a gift. Children are a gift from him. It's an inheritance and a blessing from him that we receive. This is Ephesians 6. If you look at the very beginning of the chapter here, verse 1. Verse 1 says, children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother, which is the first commandment with promise, that it may be well with you and you may live long on the earth. And you, fathers, do not provoke your children to wrath, but bring them up in the training and admonition of the Lord. I always find it amazing that, you know, he gives areas where he's given instruction to men and women, and then when he moves on to the kids, he still has to go back to the dads again. Like, hey, just remember, we need that extra help. We need that extra help of going, we want to put them in a good position. We don't want to set them up for failure. And that's what we can do at times if we're not careful with how we treat them, with how we interact with them, the things that we say, how far we push them. And that's what this is talking about. He says, you know, don't provoke them to wrath. Don't push them beyond their limits. Don't push them beyond what they're able to control themselves. Because that's what God's all about. God is all about control. Everything that we do, everything we say, everything we look at, the way that we act, all of it's about self-control. And he goes, fathers, you can push your kids past a point where they lose control. He says, don't do that. Don't do that. That's defeating the purpose of what you're trying to create, what you're trying to build. I always love that there's a promise in here. This is a promise to the children. It all stems from what God gives us. He tells us the ultimate purpose here. He says, honor your father and mother, which is the first commandment, with promise that it may be well with you and you may live long on the earth. He goes, if you implement this, if you do these things right, your life will be good. You'll be successful. You'll have a good life. We often feed off of each other's experiences. We don't all have to go through everything in life because we have relationships. We see what God has done. We see how he does it. That's why I love visiting so much. That's why I love hearing about people's callings. So, and if you had a chance to read through the United News, that was a big section, the first article in the United News that I sent out last night. It's talking about, ask people, how were you called? Because they're all different. They're all unique. Some people were born into it and they have somewhere along the lines, they have to make it their own. Other people are called later in life. But everybody's story is unique to them. God has built this family for a very specific reason. These human families teach us what his family is supposed to look like if we do this right. If we follow the instructions that he gives to us. Now we can completely damage the relationships. We can do nothing productive with it if we make the wrong decisions and choices. But we have to follow the opposite instructions of God to do that. Otherwise, things generally fall in place. Now, we know people are going to make their own decisions. Children have to grow up and make their own decisions, and it doesn't matter what instructions we give them. They may choose to go a different way. Just like humans, we either choose to obey God or we choose to turn away from God. Everybody has to make a decision. But we don't ever want to do anything to stifle our children. We want to set them up for success. And that's exactly how God treats us. He puts us into the positions where we will be most successful, where things will work out, where we're productive. Everything right now that we experience, that we go through, is to teach us how to be better children of God. How to be better children of God. How to literally be first fruits. It's a big job. If you turn over to Psalm 127 and verse 3, this is Psalm 127. If you look at verse 3. Yes, unfortunately, our children do at times need discipline. But we have to be very careful of how that's enforced. Because we always want to do it in a way that produces growth. We don't ever want to do it out of anger. We don't want to do it out of frustration. We don't want to do it out of fear. But we do it through love and we do it through compassion. Here in verse 3 of Psalm 127, we read, behold, children are a heritage from the Lord. The fruit of the womb is a reward. Like arrows in the hand of a warrior, so are the children of one's youth. Happy is the man who has his quiver full of them. They shall not be ashamed, but shall speak with their enemies at the gates. The children bring a joy to a family.
Nope.
So much so that everybody shows up at the hospital. We can't wait to see the new baby. We can't wait to hold the new baby. We can't wait to snuggle the baby. We go to the hospital when people are at their worst, and mothers are like, nobody's coming in here. Nobody wants to see me like this. I don't want anybody to see me like this. And everybody comes in anyway, right? Because we want to see the new baby. We want to see this new life. And when you think about ultimately what children do, that there's a lot of things that they provide. At a young age and at an old age. As we grow, they guard against loneliness and abandonment in old age. And they can also bring honor to a family. We get very proud of their accomplishments, their achievements, when they do different things, when they honor the family name. That is the one thing I grew up remembering. Never to embarrass my family name. My dad drilled that into us boys. Do not embarrass the family. It's because we want to leave a good impression everywhere we go. We don't want people to think bad. And even back in biblical times, it was thought to be a blessing. It was a symbol of strength to have many children. To be a productive family. You think about their society. They were generally an agricultural economy. And so the extra hands would help increase the amount that they could produce, what they could farm, their productivity. So that was extra food, extra income. I don't know if it offsets having three teenage boys. I don't know if that offsets the amount of food that they consume. I'd be interested in knowing how much land I have to farm that they actually start becoming income versus outcome. But also, a man with a large family, he wasn't afraid. There was a measure of respect that he would receive. And in that last line there, he says, but shall speak with their enemies in the gates. You know, when they did business, when they had business transactions, they would meet at the city gates. And so it's mentioning here going, hey, even somebody who's an enemy, who doesn't get along, they have a little thought in the back of their mind when this big old massive family shows up of, I'm not going to start anything crazy with this guy. There's a security in that. They think twice before taking in bad actions, before saying something bad about them, or before doing something violent towards them. Now, there's going to be repercussions. That big family is going to not just stand there and watch. And so we see this. And they always believed, too, that having a large family was somebody receiving God's favor. God producing children was something beneficial for those families. And they saw it as a direct blessing from God. You know, hopefully, all of this brings to mind going back to the Father. When we think about what we do with our families here, our God, we need to step back and ask the question of, who is the Alpha in your life and in your family? Because if we misunderstand that, if that's not spot on with what we're doing, everything that we've talked about doesn't matter. If we have these wrong orders, because misunderstanding this, it'll mess up our marriages, it'll mess up our parenting, our leadership. All of that will be out of alignment if we don't understand the family structure of God. Because he's mirroring everything off of his family. He's going, this is what my family's looked like. This is what I want from it. This is what I want you to do. And they can be tricky because we don't see this in the world. We don't see it around us from everybody else. If anything, family is getting minimized. It is being less thought about, less talked about, non-committal. But everything with God, he goes, I want you all in. I want you fully invested. Not in conflict or fighting for control, but this perfect unity. This unity that I have. If you look at Revelation chapter 22, verse 13. If you go all the way back real quick. Revelation 22. I think we'll actually pick this up in verse 12. If I remember, when we hear that phrase Alpha and Omega, we often think about God, but we have to be precise. And this here in Revelation 22, it points to specifically to Jesus. Specifically to Jesus Christ, it is never this power struggle between the Father and the Son. It's not a fight. It's not a dispute. They don't squabble over recognition. They don't squabble over status quo or anything else. This is what it says in Revelation 22. If you look at verse 12. Verse 12 says, "And behold, I am coming quickly, and my reward is with me, to give to everyone according to his work. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end, the first and the last. Blessed are those who do his commandments, that they might have the right to the tree of life, and may enter through the gates into the city. But outside are dogs and sorcerers and sexually immoral and murderers and idolaters and whoever loves and practices a lie." Now, Jesus Christ is the Alpha and Omega in this sense. And he can be the Alpha and Omega because it's not a battle of who has superiority, of who has the last word. You know, Jesus was the one that stood at the beginning and at the end of mankind's plan. We know they built that plan together. Through Jesus Christ, everything was created. It says nothing was created without him. He has been involved in the process the whole way. He's been directly involved ever since. He has been walking with us, hoping that we'll just follow his lead. That's what the camp theme this year is all about. Mr. Cobb may have mentioned that this year's camp theme is follow me. The direct quotes from Jesus Christ of follow me. We realize, thankfully, we have the Old and New Testament. We see a different perspective than the Israelites did. We have a completely different perspective than most of humanity that's ever lived. Because we understand Jesus Christ was the Word who was working with God's people all the way. He has never left us. He has never forgotten about us. And it reveals something greater about the family. It's never about power. It's never about individuals. It's about building this family, making sure everybody thrives. Because he says, I want to save as many as I possibly can. If you turn over to 1 Corinthians chapter 8 and verse 4. 1 Corinthians 8, 4. You know, Paul addresses an issue that ultimately comes down to conscience. At this time, meat had been offered in the markets that had previously been used in pagan temples and the worship of those false gods. And then some of the believers were misunderstanding that, you know, this meat was now idols. It had been offered to these false gods. We can't buy this, even though it was clean meats that they could eat. And so they thought they would spiritually defile themselves, and they struggled with this. And there was this conflict in the church at Corinth because some of them are going, no, this is clean meat. It's fine to eat. And the other ones are going, well, we can't touch this. And some of that may be because of their background, their involvement in idolatry. We have the same thing today. Sometimes there's hymns, sometimes different songs. Sometimes the way that we do things, it brings red flags for people because of their background, because of churches that they came out of, because of their upbringing. It sets them off a little bit. And they go, oh, that's affiliated with this. I don't want anything to do with that. Not necessarily a sin, not bad, but it just takes us down a bad path that we don't want to be in. And so they were struggling with this, and to them, eating that meat would have been a sin for them because they felt like they would still be participating in that idolatry, that worship of those false gods. And so this is what we find in 1 Corinthians 8. If you look at verse 4, verse 4 says, "Therefore, concerning the eating of things offered to idols, we know that an idol is nothing in the world, and that there is no other God but one. For even if there are so-called gods, whether in heaven or on earth, as there are many gods and many lords, yet for us there is one God, the Father, of whom are all things, and we for him, and one Lord Jesus Christ, through whom are all things, and through whom we live." This is showing us the ultimate authority. The Father is the ultimate authority, but he's bringing everything into subjection to Jesus Christ. Jesus clearly has a role in everything that we do. That's why he became the example for us. Everything that has transpired, he is actively working through God's plan, the Father's plan. And Christ has many titles. He's got many different roles that we find throughout the Bible. And that's where the symbolism sometimes break down. And it feels a little funny, right? Lord, Master, Savior, High Priest. Those are all usually good. And then we get into brother and bridegroom, and we're going, all right, we're losing this here. That's why the world sometimes struggles with some of what his role is and how he's viewed, is because for us, we're told, you know, don't marry your brother. And so the symbolism breaks down, but the functionality of it does not. The functionality, God shows us what this family really means. Not a battle about who has the authority. Yeah, Christ is over the church, but he's also with us. God has put his Holy Spirit in us, leading us, preparing us for the different jobs. And it's through the Father. The Father says, I'm the one that called him. Christ says, whoever the Father calls, I'm going to work with. It's this perfect union, this family that they're bringing us into. You know, as the world has wrongly evaluated wolf packs and how they function, what they actually look like, you know, humans have equally butchered what it means to be a family, haven't we? What a family unit's supposed to look like today is very different than what God intended. The real goal of family is not control, it's not power, and it's really not even structure. The structure is just a part of the functionality. It helps us to work through things. It helps us to make decisions at the end of the day. But the goal really is alignment with the family of God. It's alignment with the family of God because he's showing us, this is the structure I use. This is how I've done it. He goes, and if you can implement these things, your family will be successful. It'll work. Our job is to reflect the Father's authority, Christ's leadership and sacrifice. Display that unity that they have. Not ever pulling because we think one's getting more than me. But this perfect unity. That's an amazing thing that we see what family brings when we do it properly. What it can produce. Because when we implement God's structure, our families stop being a place of confusion. And they become a reflection of God's family that we're going to see at the kingdom of God. And it's all going to make sense to the rest of the world because they're going to look and go, that makes sense. That's why they worked so well together. That's why their kids were respectful. All of these things will start to make more sense. And so biblical leadership isn't about being the smartest or the strongest or even having the last word in a family. It's about being responsible for filling the roles that God has given us gifts to do. What we can produce. Because that creates the godly unity, unified structure that he intended from the very beginning. And when we follow that unity and we follow that structure, we do have a perfect family.